Good morning or good day to you, and thank you, Tim, for your introductory remarks reminding me of that period in my life. And it's amazing how small this world is, that you actually know some people that were very my neighbors in the town where I grew up. I'm delighted and thankful to be here, and I'm thankful for all the organizers for putting this conference together, rethinking public faith. I have been concerned with public faith, with issues of public faith for quite some time. Grew up in the circumstances in which that was a background concern, but could never be articulated because there wasn't enough space to do so, wasn't enough freedom to do so. But since that time, I have pursued the question, and more recently, some of you have seen, I've published a little book called A Public Faith. And what I've done in this book is I've tried to explore how the followers of Christ, how those who are committed to not only kind of experience of Christ's presence and energizing, vitalizing presence, but also committed to follow Christ and Christ's teaching, ought to engage in public realm in a pluralistic world today. And some of what I'm going to say is going to be informed by those concerns. But what I'm going to do also during these four lectures that I will deliver is I'm going to make a kind of step almost, well, I was going to say further away from the Christian faith, but it's actually looking at a phenomena from the heart of Christian faith that engages other worldviews and other faiths, recognizing their own presence in the world today. I've been writing a book recently on faiths and globalization. Now, you can write a book of this sort by kind of stepping out of any faith, in a sense, right, and looking at the world of faiths and non-faith for some allegedly neutral standpoint. Now, as it turns out, I think that there isn't anything like that. There isn't any neutral standpoint from which we could survey the field of all faiths and non-faiths and then ask the question, well, how do they live together in this increasingly intertwined, interconnected world where we all end up living, whether in Australia or United States or in Europe, actually under a single common roof, increasingly so. So what I've tried to do is I needed to address how different faiths ought to relate to one another and to globalization processes, but I couldn't do that from a neutral standpoint. And so I did what I think came natural to me. I kind of sketched a vision from a distinctly Christian perspective. Now that's a kind of risky endeavor. It's a risky endeavor because some folks might think that I'm kind of projecting my own Christian faith onto them. I'm defining them. I'm sort of kind of colonizing discourse, to use the vocabulary that's often used in the circles in which I move, that I'm kind of projecting onto them and then telling them how to march. I hope that we are, and I think that we are past that point where Christians can engage in colonizing discourse. We live in radically pluralistic world, and I think there's no back from that. And if we live in this radically pluralistic world, I think what we also as Christians need to do is we need to kind of offer to other faiths and non-faiths a vision in which they could possibly be imagine themselves as living and invite them to return the favor to us, so that we can together, in a pluralistic way, organize our common world together. Now, as I'll try to argue, that in no way, absolutely in no way, entails compromising of the Christian vision, but rather, I think it can be seen, and it can be done, as an expression of deep Christian commitments. At least that's what I am aiming to do. And some of you who know my work that is kind of robustly and deeply Christian, you might think I'm stepping away from that tradition. I'm not, or at least I'm trying not to. I'm providing a kind of a setup in which we can then articulate Christian vision in a very robust way. And maybe just to illustrate that, and so that's all by the way of introduction, maybe to illustrate that in the center that I run, I have, and we have two central programs. And one program is called God and Human Flourishing. And it's a program that's the heart of the center's work. And that is basically an attempt to explicate the meaning and significance of the life and the presence of Christ for what it means to flourish as a human being today. And it's a kind of robustly Christian project centered fundamentally around God as revealed in Jesus Christ. But then in circumference of that, I teach a course at Yale for undergrads called Life Worth Living. And there we look at the six alternative accounts of what is a flourishing life and ask the question, try to stimulate the students to ask the question, what deep meaning for them might there be there? What truth claims are there that they have to either embrace or resist? Rather than look at these faiths in a distancing kind of way, to engage them at the level of their truth claims. I think both of these projects are essential. Indeed, for me, in order to articulate the Christian faith in the right way, I need to situate it in this larger context of what is there in a globalized world. And so I'm going to be meandering between kind of distinctly Christian convictions and the implications that that might have and the invitations that that might issue to other worldviews, including secularism, in terms of how they might live in this pluralistic world with us as Christians. So I'll be delivering four lectures, and all four comprise a unity. And roughly what they are about, they're about faith, they're about public engagement, and they're about violence, and they're about reconciliation. And the reason why faith and public engagement is associated in my talk here with violence and reconciliation is because that's the fear of both secularists and those of other religions with regard to Christian faith and Christians with regard to especially Islam is precisely this. If you have an engaged faith, it's going to end up being a violent faith. And therefore, the questions of whether faiths and to what degree of faith, Christian faith, but other faiths as well, is violence-inducing is a very significant public question. If it's the case, right, then of course you've got to suppress the faith because it's going to destabilize everything. But if there are potentials in the faiths for reconciliation, I think things are somewhat different. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to address in the first lecture the relationship between faith, religion broader, and violence. In the second lecture, which would be this evening, I will talk about public engagement in the context of pluralistic world. I will advocate for something like a Christian account of or Christian reasons for embrace of not just democracy, but pluralistic democracy. In the third lecture, I'll attend one of the kind of major objections that one gets, namely that especially those of us who are some kind of religious exclusivists, and I count myself in one of those, I think that Christian faith is in some very significant sense true. In that sense, though I may not be consigning the rest of the world to hell, which I am not, though I may also not think that I can't learn anything from the rest of the world, I tend to embrace Christian faith because I, for myself, think that Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. Now, how do we, such religious exclusivists, and there are many stripes of us there, and I'll try to address some of those issues, how do we, and can we embrace pluralism as a political project? Now, this kind of seeming discrepancy between exclusivism at the religious level and pluralism at the political level is one of the big questions that that I think emerge in discussions about public role of faith. And then finally, this is the kind of third lecture is kind of removing one of the obstacles for faith to serve the reconciling purposes and be the agent of peace. And then the final lecture is going to be kind of resources in the Christian faith, kind of exploration of elements of reconciliation embedded in the Christian faith that can be part and parcel of our public engagement. So roughly that's the sketch of the terrain that we are going to cover these four lectures. So let me start now with the question of religion more broadly, always Christian faith implied, relationship between Christian faith and violence. Now, main sources of conflict between people are, I think they're well known. Almost four centuries ago, Thomas Hobbes might have said the last word on the matter. In his very famous book, Leviathan, written in 1651, he famously described life of human beings in the so-called state of nature, as you will recall that. Every kid has learned that in high school, I think, or at least in first year of college. State of nature is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Now, in this book, he identified three major causes of or sources of conflict. And here I quote him. First is competition. Second is diffidence. And third, glory. The first makes men invade for gain, the second for safety, and the third for reputation. The first use violence to make themselves masters of other men's persons, wives, children, and chattel. The second to defend them, the third for trifles, such as word, a smile, a different opinion, and any other sign of undervalue, either in their persons or by reflection in their kindred, their friends, their nation, their profession, or their name. So basically, gain, safety, and reputation as main sources of violence. Now, this shows up in Hobbes' book at the very beginning, talking about state of nature. As a matter of fact, he thinks that continues to be so. Now, some people think that religion is a kind of independent source of conflict. And there are many reasons why people give for that. One, religions are irrational. They make universal claims for truth, and therefore they're totalitarian. They derive their sources of authority from revelation, which you can't contest. Many different reasons are given why religions, and in particular also Christian faith, why it is violent by nature. Now, my take on this is that actually religions, historically, have contributed both to social discourse and to harmony. That's not particularly earth-shattering insight to have, that they've legitimized violence as well as peacemaking, so that as lived realities, faith are neither simply violent nor are they peaceable, but they're ambivalent. Now, religious folks, they have an explanation why faiths are violent. They generally think that faiths are peaceful, and then the explanation why they're violent is because of the basic flaw of human nature. We tend to abuse just about everything that's good, and so religion in itself is good, and we tend to simply abuse it. Now, the critics of religion, they have an explanation why faiths are sometimes peaceable. And they would say, well, you've got to temper the violent propensities of faith by the milk of human kindness. And everybody, in order to survive, has to do just that. And so both think that kind of there's something like that in its essence, religion is one way or religion is the other way. When it comes to religion and violence, both such critics and defenders tend to see religions, Christian faith included, as kind of static wholes and think of them either as violent as peaceable. Now, I think that's a mistake because it doesn't take into account kind of developments and changes within religion. And I build my comments here on the work of sociologist of David Martin, a Christian sociologist from London School of Economics. And those of you who haven't read David Martin's work, you ought to, and some of you who have only read his work on secularization, you ought to read also his book, Does Christianity Cause War? Which is a very fine book and unjustly understudied and underread. So in this book, he suggests that religions are repertoires of linked motifs internally articulated in a distinctive manner and giving rise to characteristic extrapolations about the way of life in the world. So there's a kind of, you've got the motifs, repertoire of motifs, and these various motifs can be then played up in one way or the other, depending on the setting, depending on features of culture, other religions that are present, and the needs of political power, and depending on interests of people, the character of religion changes. Some motifs from this repertoire are backgrounded, others are foregrounded, most are played with various types of degrees of attunement or kind of discrepancy, discordance. So depending on circumstances, faiths will look differently. Now, in missiological literature today, we call that inculturation, right? And there is an element to this. Or some of you who have studied history of Christianity, you would notice a major shift that occurs in Christian faith when Christianity becomes a state religion of the Roman Empire. Now, why has this shift occurred? It has occurred because of the changed circumstances, and if you carefully studied, you'll have a set of motifs that are very differently played, and almost like alternative accounts of the Christian faith, given those kinds of circumstances. Now, Christian faith is not infinitely malleable. You can't make do anything with it. They're kind of tied to origins, but nonetheless, there's this malleability. And some of these transformations of faith are violence-inducing, and some of them are peace-fostering. And so one of the central questions that we need to ask, under what, not whether religion, whether Christian faith, let's stay with the Christian faith, whether Christian faith is violent or whether Christian faith is peaceful or peace-inducing, peacemaking, but we have to ask, under what condition is it turned into a violent religion, and under what condition can it be peace-producing or peace-inducing? And this is what David Martin actually does. And he picks up on what in the kind of intellectual political tradition of the West are two important ways to think about the role of religion in public life. And one of these comes from from Hobbes, which I've already indicated. He thought that religions are employed as tools of government. So basically, governments need certain kinds of legitimation, they need certain kinds of tools, and they craft religions so that they can achieve their own goals. Now, that's a very important thing for us to keep in mind, especially when we later when I start talking about the relationship between religion and politics. Closer religion comes to the power, more it's likely to be used as an instrument of that power, crafted to the purposes of that political power. That's kind of the thrust of Hobbes' comment. Of course, Hobbes himself wouldn't have quite put it in as positive of term as I have put it now, but that's where his comment is, I think, tending. And the other one is Immanuel Kant. And Kant thought that religions serve as kind of boundary markers, identity markers. Along with language, religions distinguish the groups within humanity. They mark the boundaries. And so you have here political power and the boundary-making function. Now, in David Martin's work, these two end up being combined. And so he asks, gives them sociological twists, and then he asks the question, so under what conditions will Christian faith become violent? And he says this, these special circumstances occur when religion becomes virtually coextensive with society and thus with the dynamics of power, violence, control, cohesion, and making out or marking out of boundaries. Now, this temptation to blend state, religion, and society is strong, and three together, they generate kind of high levels of solidarity. And so religions end up being something like, in Emil Durkheim's terms, collective representations of social unity. Now, that's the state in which I think most religions turn violent. We can go through a variety of examples, and I'll give some examples shortly, to illustrate that that's really the case for the Christian faith as well as for other faiths. Now, my sense is, my contention is, that world religions, and let's stay also with Christianity, that Christianity has to be turned into marker of identity and legitimizer of political power. That it's, in its original vision, it isn't that. That in its original vision, there is a clear distinction between religion as a cultural system and politics, economics, as a cultural system. And that division is fundamental to Christianity, other world faiths. And it's fundamental because Christianity works, Christian faith works with what Nietzsche has critically, but I think accurately, described as a two worlds account of reality. There is transcendent realm, there is an immanent realm. And transcendent realm is a source of the immanent realm and orientation for the immanent realm. Faith is about allegiance, primary allegiance to transcendence, and therefore faith cannot be simply reduced, identified with, closely tied to the politics of power, but stands always in a tension-filled relationship. So I want to distinguish maybe for the purposes of our discussion further in the all four lecture, I want to distinguish categorically between what can be described as political religions. You have today, for instance, political Islam. You had earlier political Christianity. That is the religions closely tied with the nexus of society, politics, and politics, right? And political or public engagement of religions. These two are categorically, I think, different. And my argument is going to be political religions are bad, are wrong. Political engagement of faiths or public engagement of faiths is exactly what ought to happen. And when you have political religions, then you also have religions that legitimize violence, and in conflicts, they tend to then be violence-inducing. Now, when faiths become markers of group identity, they tend to exacerbate conflicts by providing groups with the aura of the sacred and thus energizing and legitimizing struggles. Inversely, conflicts between groups associated predominantly with a single faith push those faiths to morph into markers of group identity. And similar thing happens with association between religion and power. You know, I come from former Yugoslavia. You will recall the wars in former Yugoslavia. And in many ways, that's what you had. To be a Croatian is to be Catholic. To be Serbian is to be Orthodox. Never mind that 60% of population, even during communist era, of Orthodox population didn't believe in God. Right? It's a relatively low level of belief in God in Serbia at that time. But they were all Orthodox, right? There was association in imagination between Orthodoxy and the particular ethnic group. So it was also in Croatia. And Muslims at that time, they were designated as an ethnic group. They're Muslims, right? But they were actually Slavs who have converted to Islam, right? And properly described as Bosniaks. And so you had these three groups which closely tied themselves with the particularities of their ethnic belonging and therefore also with the dynamics of power. And once you had that, religion was clearly then implicated in the conflict. Certainly conflicts were not simply religious conflict. And I remember people often have asked me, so was that a conflict about religion Was it about politics? Was it about economics? Was it about culture? Was it about language? And the answer, of course, is yes. It was about those things. Because no kind of monocausal explanation of such conflicts is ever plausible. But you had this nexus of religion and cultural identity and politics, and by the way, also in some way economics, though economics tends to play slightly different role. And then religions were implicated in violence. I think perhaps the best example, I've given you one now example, but perhaps the best example of such reconfiguration of faith, and I haven't spoken so much about reconfigurations of faith, but they have happened. Christian faith ends up being reconfigured. Perhaps the best example of such reconfiguration of faith by tight association with the social group and the rule is the paradox of a Sri Lankan Buddhist monk who has taken to the gun. Now, you have a reason why I'm giving this, because in Buddhism, right, kind of monks aren't supposed to come close to guns, right? You stay with the non-violence is a kind of one of the fundamental commitments. Chastity and non-violence are fundamental commitments. And yet you have in Sri Lanka, monks who take up the gun. You've got it also in Burma as well. Buddhist monks are supposed to be deeply committed to nonviolence. They're required not only to refrain from killing, but to keep at a distance from armies and traffic in arms. Not so in Sri Lanka in the second half of the 20th century and even earlier. According to Stanley Tambia, many Sri Lankan monks came to believe that the religion of the Buddha and the language and culture of the Sinhalese cannot flourish without a sovereign territory, which is the motherland of Sri Lanka. Now that's your key move. To give legs to this belief, they embraced political Buddhism. Again, the political Christianity, political Islam, political Buddhism, built on certain canonical suttas dealing with ideal righteous rulers and the Buddhist goal of muting worldly desires. Political Buddhism stood against divisive party politics and hankering after West-inspired materialist, consumerist, and capitalist self-seeking goals, and proposed in their place a simpler, harmonious Buddhist way of life in a Buddhist democracy. Now, you got to kind of parse out a number of things that are happening here, right? Some of these things you might resonate as quite right, and yet all of them are enlisted in this goal of political Buddhism. In the process, the substantively soteriological, ethical, and normative components of canonical doctrinal Buddhism qua religion were weakened, displaced, and even distorted. Not just its character primarily as an ego ideal and a mental discipline for personal salvation, but it stands for toward violence as well. As the sons of Buddha took on the identity of the sons of the soil, here we go, the fundamental difference, right? Sons of Buddha, sons of the soil. You've got similar thing in Christianity often happening. Their religion was reconfigured, and the affirmation of violence slithered itself into an essentially non-violent faith. So all of this, both Christian examples, I could give examples from Islam as well, and they, for many of you, might come most naturally, and that's why I'm choosing Buddhist and Christian examples, because we pride ourselves to be a civilized, democratic, pluralistic, and so forth, fourth faiths, but our history kind of belies that claim. The single most significant factor in determining whether a faith will be implicated in violence or not is this: the level of its identification with a political project and of its entanglement with the agents that strive to realize it. The more identified a faith is with a political project and with the agents of its realization, and the more likely it will be for it to take up the gun. Now, in my book, Public Faith, I have distinguished between so-called thick religions and thin religions. They're not fat and skinny religions, right? I use this thick and thin from, there's a long tradition from Gilbert Ryle to Kilford Geertz and other folks. And thick faith maps a way of life. It fosters a sense of connection with the ultimate reality, sketches a moral vision embedded in the account of self, social relations, and the good. In other words, it's kind of robust faith that is articulated as faith and then has a kind of history of engagement and reflection with it. All of our faiths have traditions, right? Why is it that when we as Christians, theologians, and maybe non-theologians want to write about Christianity and war, you know, they're kind of crucial seminal books that you have to read from authors that have shaped our sensibilities, and we engage in a debate with them. I think that's a healthy understanding of what one might describe as a thick religion. Thin religion is one from which the kind of the bottom of faith had fallen out. And what you are left then is kind of this aura of the sacred that stabilizes your identity, a kind of sense of devotion that can be then used, manipulated by other forces and placed into a service of their goals. In other words, faith doesn't define your goals. It just energizes you and helps you on the way to achieve those goals. Sometimes I've called this, I think I do that also in public faith, it's a kind of religion as performance-enhancing drug and religion as divine band-aid. Right? So these are kind of these two major functions. We want somehow to succeed, and we need a little bit of a boost, competitive advantage. So we pray, so we are uncertain what's going to happen, and then we hope that we're going to have some boost of concentration and maybe some flash of insight so we can legitimately cheat on our exams. No. Right? Or win a soccer game, you know, with an extra divine player on the field or something of that sort. It's kind of performance-enhancing drug. Or we walk through life, we get hurt, we kind of our knees are bloody, and we need a little bit of soothing balm on them, a little bit of a band-aid, and we can run. But what happens is faith is not determining where we are running. Faith is just helping us run and making sure when we fall, we can pick ourselves up and reach that goal. Now, that's thinned out faith because it has stopped shaping who I am. It has stopped shaping the set of relationships that I have. It has stopped giving the goal of my life by articulating the good which I should strive. Once you have this thick faith describing these things and, of course, emotionally inspiring you to do them, ritually stabilizing this. Notice I'm using all these secular terms. I can, of course, express them very much in Christian terms, and it will be much more accurate to do so. Once you have Christ who lives actually within you, Christ who, as one living in you, is the one who sets the goals for you, and you make your story, he makes his story your story, that's thick faith. That's the faith that shapes life, and that's the faith that then, I think, is least likely to be instrumentalized in order to create violence. The more secular our faith is, thin faith is a secularized faith. It's kind of completely used into the function of secular goals. There are multiplicity of ways in which it's being done. A little footnote, we don't have only political religions. We have a health and wealth religions. Political religions are those in which faith is instrumentalized as a tool of political power and social cohesion. Health and wealth religions are those where religion has been instrumentalized in order to achieve the goals of health and wealth, prosperity, whatever it is that we desire, more at an economic level, right? And these are two major strands of malfunctions of faith that you have. But thinner they are, the more secular they are. You see how the goals are secular? The goals are political stability. The goals are economic prosperity. That's a secular goal into which faith has been, toward which faith has been employed. That kind of faith, I think, ends up being a violent faith. But faiths aren't always tools crafted and used by combatants in conflicts, whether these are governments or communal leaders. Sometimes even what I have described, a thick faith, can generate conflicts. Whatever that thick faith is, it's a way of life. And ways of life often don't sit very well next to each other. And visions of who the self is, visions of what the social relations should be, visions of what the good is, can sometimes conflict. They may significantly overlap, but even small differences can sometimes be, in concrete situation, very significant and create collisions. So in other words, it's not enough for you simply to thicken your faith. You've got to also do something else in addition in order to avoid violence. Let me give you an example of a very thick faith that also is conflict generating. Here's the example from the Christian faith. Arguably, the teachings of Jesus, with its stress on generosity, non-retaliation, love of enemy, is among the most peaceable of all religious teachings. As such, it can illustrate, I think, well, conflict-generating character of faith's practice thickly. Now, famously, and to some people shockingly, Jesus said, "Do not think that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and one's foes will be members of one's own household." I have come to bring sword. Now, when have you heard last time preached on this? It's been a while since I have. And then you've got the preacher kind of fidgeting, and you can just see with wide steps how he or she is avoiding, I mean, the heart of the matter, because it's very uncomfortable teaching. Now, remember these three causes of violence that I mentioned at the beginning: gain, safety, and reputation. And now you might ask, well, so why and how did Jesus come to bring sword? Not because he provided religious legitimacy to quarrels around gain, security, and reputation. Not because he advocated faiths making use of the state's sword, or states, governments, availing themselves of faith's word. To the contrary, when Jesus' followers take up the sword over those issues, they betray his teachings. About gain, what did he teach? Do not store up for yourself treasures on earth. About safety, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. About reputation, if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, you've got to strike with the left hand. With the right hand, you have to strike backhandedly, right? To strike onto the right cheek. And that was considered to be particularly insulting. If anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn also the other. The sword that Jesus came to bring doesn't stand around for conflict about gain, safety, or reputation. Instead, it symbolizes conflict about person's ultimate allegiance and the way of life entailed in it. Here's how he explains, why is it that he sets a man against his father and a daughter against her mother? Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever does not take up the cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Those who find their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it. Ultimate allegiances often clash. Here the contrast is family versus Jesus. Notice it's a question of ultimate allegiance. Notice that Jesus' statement is comparative. It's not absolute. It's not who loves me rather than family, but who loves or doesn't love me more than, right? It's a contrast between family, primacy of family or primacy of Jesus. Ways of life often clash. Here, pleasure and self-preservation versus losing life in self-sacrificial love. And therefore, people with different ultimate allegiances and with different ways of life, they clash. Especially they clash when they lived in shared space. Now, the critical question here is, because this touches the very heart of the faith. This is not thinned out faith, instrumentalized into conflict. This is the faith, right? This is the very heart of it. And then the critical question is whether faith, whether Christian faith, has resources to manage conflicts, not to avoid conflicts. There is no avoiding of conflict. But to manage conflict that their difference generates, to prevent conflicts from turning violent, to treat sword as a symbol for struggle over the salutary way of life and its public implications, rather than an instrument of spilling blood. Do we have resources to do that? Now, this is a very important question, because processes of globalization, and some people think, you know, that processes of globalization are actually helping to pacify the world. A famous book was written by a Harvard professor, Better Angels of Our Nature. And I don't know if you've seen it here, it has been discussed, but basic argument is that over the centuries, the levels of violence have consistently declined, and that we today live in the most peaceable of times in which humanity has ever lived. That indeed, even the bloody 20th century was most peaceable than most other periods of human history. Now, your eyebrows are going up. You're saying, where did this man live? How can anybody make an argument of this sort? And basic, I think the basic kind of shift in imagination that needs to happen in order to appreciate what he is saying. And of course, details are problematic in his book. This thick book has a lot of data, assembled data. I think very, very interesting, but sometimes problematic. But the key point is, don't look in absolute numbers. Look at relative numbers. And the sense of preponderance of violence in this century is because of the absolute numbers. Of course, absolute numbers count because every single life counts. So you can't kind of dismiss that. But his point is slightly different. He says, well, what's the likelihood that if you walk down the street, that you would actually be killed or you would stay alive? And likelihood of that is actually higher in previous centuries and in primitive societies than it is now. But that makes it, I think, nonetheless, even if that's true, we live in a world in which we, many of us, live huddled together, and therefore this being together under common roof often generates a sense of, or pushes us in some ways, toward conflict. Now, the question is that I've asked, what can we make these conflicts around faith? Can we make them productive? Can they be conflicts that are managed in such a way that we can make progress through them? To make them productive, I think the parties involved need to meet two basic requirements. First, each needs to grant to the other freedom to take responsibility over their lives and to choose the way of life they deem best. In other words, something like a full, robust freedom of religion and our religion needs to be in place. freedom not just to believe in private or practice in community, but freedom to choose one's religion, and significantly enough, freedom to abandon it as well. Now, second, the parties must embrace the principle of reciprocity, the golden rule. And I can make an argument about other faiths, but I make argument here for the Christian faith. Freedom of religion, even though it has been such an incredibly contested good over the centuries, is actually a substantive good of the Christian faith. It's not that you have a Christian faith and then we kind of decide whether it's also freely that you choose that. But rather, you can't have a Christian faith without freedom of choosing it. One believes with heart. And if you don't believe with heart, you've got the shell of it, but you don't have a substance of it. So the freedom is fundamental. So is also a golden rule. And I could make an argument that this is the case in all world faiths, that this is the case, and some of my Muslim friends, maybe many of them would disagree, this is the case also in Islam. So let me pull together now and give you four principles in which faiths can be, or Christian faiths certainly, can be not violence-inducing, but promoting peace. And these go something like this. First, guard faith's independence from political power and resist employing it as a marker of communal identity. Guard its independence and resist employing it as a marker of communal identity. What that means, for instance, for Lord's Prayer in Australia, in your parliament, I'm not quite sure, but you'll decide on that question. Two, concentrate on faith's vision of life well lived, drawing on the full resources of original revelation and subsequent tradition. In other words, don't thin out your faith. Stay away from political power. Don't thin out your faith. Three, embrace complete freedom of religion, freedom to practice, freedom to choose, freedom to reject. And fourth, don't compromise the golden rule. In everything, says the golden rule, you should do unto others as you want them to do unto you. In everything, means in politics, too. Thank you very much.